This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good evening and welcome to the Jeffrey B. Graham Perspectives on Ocean Science Speaker Series. My name is Cheryl Peach and I'm a program scientist here at the Birch Aquarium at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, UC San Diego. It's a great pleasure this evening to introduce our speaker, Dr. Marty Ralph. We have a fascinating talk for you this evening. Marty's an atmospheric scientist here at Scripps. He's the director of the Center for Western Weather and Water Extremes, and you'll hear a lot about that tonight. It's a partnership that's based here at Scripps, but it also includes NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, the California Water Department of Water Resources, the California-Nevada Applications Project, and the Sonoma County Water Agency. Now, I really wanted to take a minute just to read you the mission of this center because I think it really captures what the center is all about. It's really multifaceted. The mission is to provide 21st century water cycle science, technology, and outreach to support effective policies and practices that address the impacts of extreme weather and water events on the environment, people, and economy of Western North America. And Marty is going to bring that really fascinating story to us this evening, so please join me in welcoming Marty for his talk titled Atmospheric Rivers, California's Rainmakers. Marty, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Cheryl, and thanks everybody for joining us tonight on this beautiful April evening. I just moved here about a year and a half ago from Colorado, which is also very nice in the spring, but I got to say the view here, you know, you just can't beat it. Plus, we get these atmospheric rivers, which I really like. So I really do appreciate the chance to share with you some of the things we've been working on for some time, and I'd like to give you a little bit of a travelogue through how we got to where we are today, and then a little bit about where we're headed next, and along the way, you know, why we think this work could be useful outside science itself, but you'll see a taste of that, especially at the end. So my name's Marty Ralph, and I'm great and happy to be at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego, starting a new stage of my career and joining with a lot of very talented people here. So this photo I want to mention is from Northern California off the Russian River where it meets the ocean, and it was during a big El Nino storm in 1998, before we even understood what an atmospheric river was, really. And it wasn't until after that experiment we really were able to look back and realize this is what we were looking at. So let me give you a little bit of a story of how we got there. Well, first of all, just a snapshot of what an atmospheric river is as a preamble. This is a schematic from a paper by Dettinger and Ingram, published in Scientific American about a year and a half ago, and 2 years ago now. And it sums up work we've done over about 10 years with an emphasis on the potential for big flooding events to hit California in the future. And it looks back in a paleoclimate way. But the thing I like about this most is, first of all, the schematic, which shows an atmospheric river coming off the ocean and reaching towards the coast, rising up over the coastal mountains. Right here, you can see it progress up over the coastal mountains, and that's where the rain and snow forms initially and then drops into the Central Valley and back up the Sierras. And notice the width of this. This is sort of to scale. It's really only a couple hundred miles wide, and that's where most of the action is. And I'll get to that in just a moment. So the seminal study in my estimation for this topic is by investigators from MIT named Zhu and Newell, who published a paper in 1998, the very same year as that picture on the first page of the slide. And the very same year we had a field experiment going on off of California using research aircraft. And what they found are these narrow regions, which are highlighted in these red circles, where the atmosphere was transporting horizontally an incredible amount of water vapor. And what they concluded is that more than 90% of the water vapor transport horizontally in the mid-latitudes of the atmosphere, that's from like 20 north to 70 north roughly, 90% of that was in this handful of atmospheric river events. And you can see them here, like four or five of them at one time. If you add up the width of each one of those relative to the circumference of the Earth, it's only 10% or less. So these narrow ribbons are doing most of the work. And since then, we've come to have some new satellite data that has allowed us to get a special look at them. And this is a comparison of the traditional satellite data that was around for decades before the mid-90s. And this shows what a meteorologist would drool over is up here. This feature going into Oregon and Washington looks very important. Down here, not so much. Then we go to the next type of image, which has a misnomer of water vapor image in our jargon. And once again, you see the action looks up here, sort of a yawn in here. But then with this new type of satellite measurement that specifically makes a measurement of the total water vapor content in the atmosphere from the ground to space, showed us something profoundly different. It just stands out like a sore thumb. And right in here was pretty much nothing of really interest in the traditional satellite imagery. And we see this hitting the coast here. And this became sort of our signature for atmospheric rivers. And I highlight it with the red outline here. And it's really not very complicated. The signature in this parameter is long and narrow with large water vapor content. And how much water vapor is there in the atmosphere from the surface to space? If we went straight up from here to space, took every water vapor molecule and condensed it into liquid, anybody hazard to guess how deep it might be?
Couple inches,
that is the best guess I've ever heard in the many times I've asked that. You get an A for today's lecture. It's about 2 centimeters. Actually, it's even a bit less than that, so about an inch or less. All of the rain and snow that we depend upon comes from an atmosphere that carries that little amount of water vapor. So how that water vapor is moved around horizontally and vertically, how it runs into aerosol particles of dust to start condensing on, the story of that is the story of how we have water to live and how our environment depends on that. So it's a tough problem in many ways, technically, and a very important one. And this pattern we saw in this data really opened a new chapter in our science on how water vapor is transported in the atmosphere. And we've used this pattern now extensively. Here's an example of an observation globally here. That previous image was just from the Pacific. Here you can see the Pacific, the Atlantic. And here's an atmospheric river. This is from last December hitting Northern California. Thank goodness we got 2 ARs, as we call them, this year. We'd be even worse, in worse shape. There's another one here. There's another one here. There's another one here. Much like that image from the modeling study by Zhu and Newell. But now this is observations. Notice how the observations are not over land. That's because the measurement doesn't work over land. It can't work there for various reasons. So now that we have these data regularly from satellite, we can actually put them in motion and see how dynamic the atmosphere is. And you can see this AR spinning up and hitting California. There it is starting off. And then another one builds in right here. And a third wave comes in. And that produced about 15 inches of rain in California. You can see another one getting stretched out in the mid-Pacific. Down here you can see this. A little bit like a lava lamp from the good old days. No comment, I'm from Colorado. That was for my son. One thing we've done very recently at the behest of the California Department of Water Resources is create a one page, and we cheat because we use both sides, but it's still one page or one piece of paper, I guess. That gives you the story of California's precipitation, how it's distributed approximately, and the role of atmospheric rivers in producing a large fraction of it, and how that the ARs, how they vary from year to year, really influences whether we're in drought or flood kind of conditions. But it's a collaboration between the groups that Cheryl mentioned, who are partners with CW3E, and it's now available online, and it's going out to communities to help people be better aware of where our water comes from naturally. All right, so one of the things on that summary is the role of atmospheric rivers, and you can see another example there. I know I'm getting a bit behind here, but I'm just going to dial in on this key result right here. I'm sorry the numbers might be small for those of you in back, but this is from Dettinger and Kahan, investigators here at Scripps and CW3E, published just last year, going back about 100 years, looking at various bits of information on precipitation. And the bottom line is that these lines here show about a 5 or 10 year sort of cycle. And if we look at the number of atmospheric river events, which is what our code word here for 95th percentile, 85% of the variation from year to year in Northern California's annual precipitation is due to how many atmospheric rivers there are. So it really explains the majority of the variation from year to year in our water availability from Northern California. And this is not normal. If you look elsewhere in the country, this chart shows, and this is from Dettinger et al. 2011, how do I explain it? So if you live back east, and I'm from Michigan originally, you know, a wet year and a dry year, the difference between them is really pretty small. You know, how often does it really dry out back there? And not very. And when it does, well, a month later it rains again, and the greens right up, usually. Of course, the Great Plains can have a worse drought, and you see that here in the yellow. And what that means is that in the eastern U.S., about the variation from year to year of annual precipitation back east is about plus or minus 10%. Out here in California in the west, it can be as much as plus or minus 40%. And that's the average variation from year to year. So we are having to deal with the situation in the southwest U.S. and especially in California that is unlike anywhere else in the country. And this is one of the reasons, frankly, that I came to Scripps in California is because I went to UCLA, first of all. I didn't say that. I'm at UCSD now, sorry. But we have special challenges here. And the meteorological community has been looking at this a bit, but it just hasn't really garnered the type of attention that's needed for the region. And if you sit in D.C., you really don't have a choice but to deal with hurricanes, with nor'easters, and with tornadoes. And by the time you get down to the water problems in the west, it's much harder to relate those to your day-to-day experience, just given the nature of the atmosphere. All right, well, how extreme are the precipitation events in the west coast in particular? We looked here at the red dots basically show the most extreme rainfall totals in 3 days, over 20 inches. And where the red dots are is where those have been observed in the last, say, 60 years. And what that tells us is our California extreme events are as extreme as those associated with landfalling hurricanes when it comes to rain and runoff. And these are primarily atmospheric river events. Primarily means like 90%. Here's a snapshot of one. This was a bit of a breakthrough moment on our journey into the atmospheric river problem. This is a storm that hit Northern California and dumped a lot of rain and caused a flood on the Russian River. And I should highlight that we work very closely with the Sonoma County Water Agency, who's the water manager for the Russian River. They deal with providing the water supply for about 600,000 people for the wine country, agriculture, the tourism, and their endangered species of salmon there that depend on that very same water. And there are two reservoirs up there that they work with, the Army Corps of Engineers on, and I'll come back to that part of the story later. But you'll see a fair bit of our work has actually had a focus in Northern California on the Russian River. And we actually have offices now for CW3E in Sonoma County Water Agency to help us foster good collaborations there. This AR hit and produced heavy rain and runoff. The dots on land are the runoff. But the amazing thing is, first visit I had here, we figured out that it wasn't just this one event where we found an AR was the cause of a flood. Every event we could look at over the 7 years of data we had where there was a flood on the Russian River had an AR with it. That has led to a flood of results, including, sorry, that was lame, Washington State, same finding. Oregon, same finding. Sierra Nevada, same finding. Western Europe, same finding. Western South America, same finding. So we now know, 10 years hence, that these are the major players in flooding in important parts of the world, heavily populated in many cases. Well, they can be quite extreme at times as well. And there was a program developed by the USGS that myself and Mike Dettinger co-led a team that was involved in that. And the first we're working on an emergency preparedness scenario development. The first one they chose was for an earthquake in Southern California, sort of the epic earthquake that we might expect or do expect will happen at some point. And what they came up with was an estimate with technical input from seismologists and emergency responders and lifeline experts about what the impacts would be, a staggering $200 billion. Worth of impact in California alone from an earthquake. The next study they wanted to do was on a big flood. And it turns out there was a major flood in California in the 1860s. beyond the scope of most people's memories. It is to flooding in California. Yeah, most people's. Anyhow, there's something there. I'm forgetting, and I'm not even 150 years old. It is to flooding in California, much like the 1906 earthquake is to seismic hazards. It's just a bit earlier. So this team formed up. Mike Dettinger and I led the formulation of what the extreme event was made up of meteorologically. We had a team of about 15 experts, and we concluded it was clearly a series of atmospheric river storms. And that led to the title ARC storm, AR for atmospheric river. And this is the synopsis of it. And the remarkable result is over $500 billion worth of damage and economic disruption was predicted from this. More than two times what was expected from an earthquake. Most people, I would argue, in California don't view flood hazards as serious a risk as earthquake. And yet the studies have clearly shown that that is the case. They aren't very frequent, and they seem out of place in the climate we live in, especially in Southern California, but they're a very real risk. And USGS led the development of the following video using input. In fact, it was designed very interestingly by an art class in Pasadena. And I'd like to share this with you right now, thanks to USGS, if I can get it to operate.
California, 1862. It has rained for almost 45 days. Fierce storms have inundated a 300-mile length of the Sacramento and San Joaquin Valleys with water. In Southern California, the flooding has drowned thousands of cattle and washed away homes, food crops, and vineyards. The state is bankrupt, and many communities have been ruined and will take years to recover. Research shows that this is not the only big storm of our past, nor the largest. While the Great Flood of 1862 may no longer be in living memory, a storm of this scale is inevitable once again. This is the ARC storm. Winter, present day. Weather reports show atmospheric rivers of moisture forming in the tropics, growing larger and gaining speed as they travel towards the West Coast. The state braces for the impact of the coming storm, but the public at large does not comprehend the extreme danger the storm poses. The ARC storm slams the coast with a fury rivaling that of hurricanes, beginning a process of destruction that will last for weeks. Levees and flood control systems are overwhelmed by the incredible volume of water that has nowhere to go. Widespread flooding occurs throughout the state, severely affecting Sacramento, the Bay Delta, Los Angeles and Orange counties, San Diego, and many other communities. Over the course of the storm, as much as 10 feet of rain falls. Thousands of landslides occur, damaging homes, highways, and roads. Property damage approaches $400 billion. Much of the total loss is uninsured, so large numbers of building owners do not have the financial resources to pay for repairs. After almost a month of continuous rain, the storm finally subsides, leaving many parts of the state flooded for months to come. How will society deal with the social, economic, and environmental consequences of this tragedy? Together, we can prevent the ARC storm from becoming a major catastrophe. How can our government agencies work effectively with one another to create emergency response and evacuation plans so that instead of victims, we would have survivors? What if we could prevent the inundation of major communities through creating more advanced flood controls and levee systems? A heightened level of readiness is essential to averting this potential catastrophe. After all, preparedness is part of our civic duty and obligation to society. To learn more about the ARC storm and about how you can be part of the solution, go to www.arcstorm.com.
Well, it's a bit startling to realize the risks that are out there, and I'm very pleased to let you know that, in fact, there is a fair bit of effort going on in cooperation across agencies to look into this. We're working closely with California's Department of Water Resources on it, with the California Office of Emergency Services. USGS is leading in this regard. But it's a good example, I think, of how science has, with engineering and policymakers, been able to examine the potential for a significant catastrophic kind of event and start preparing for it. And one of the reasons we started the center here was to bring greater attention to the atmospheric river side of this equation, as well as the prediction side of it. So as much as that's a staggering risk that we're facing, these atmospheric rivers also provide a great benefit, and that is a big chunk of our water supply. And let me highlight that here with the result published a couple years ago that shows essentially in the Pacific Northwest, something like 25 to 35% of the precipitation over the 10-year period studied here happened in the relatively few atmospheric river days each year. And by the way, in California, Northern California, we average about 6 or 8 AR events per year. And they produce, as you can see from this chart, something on the order of 1/3 to even 1/2 at some locations of the precipitation for the whole year. This is really vital, obviously, to our water supply. And in this drought, it's a staggering importance. And for engineers in the room, if you've ever heard of an acre foot of water, it's an acre of land, a foot deep. That's enough water for a couple of families usually per year. In our new drought restrictions and all that, it's probably several families. And it turns out an atmospheric river can transport the equivalent of about 10 times the discharge of liquid water from the Mississippi River into the Gulf of Mexico. But it's all in water vapor. And if we get even a fraction of that to rain out, that becomes our water supply. And we think that fraction is about 1/4 of rain out. So if we're in a dry period like we are today, or during the last couple of years, it's really, the science now shows, as is highlighted in this chart here, this is an axis that shows a drought measure. And this is a 12-month period. Zero is the month in which that drought index went from drought conditions to not drought conditions, and we averaged them over many events. And what we found is that the drought breaks occur, typically about 1/2 of them occur in months that are characterized by very wet AR events. So ARs are also not only flood makers, but they also can break droughts, and they provide beneficial water supply. And this is a highlight. This highlights what the California Department of Water Resource program is doing with new information on atmospheric rivers. We put a network in, about a $10 million network across the state, and they're using it in evaluating changes in water resource system operations, in anticipating earlier runoff from snowmelt, and helping with water supply forecasting. So their data is already getting used in the Department of Water Resources applications areas. Now, how common is it for ARs to be important elsewhere in the country? This diagram highlights a detailed analysis that shows locations where a significant fraction of the heaviest daily precipitation events are due to ARs. And here's where we've learned our most, in California, then Oregon and Washington. To our surprise initially, we discovered western Idaho, Arizona, into Utah, and even into western Colorado. Key flooding events are related to atmospheric rivers penetrating inland in these regions. There's now a couple of dissertations that are being produced, have been completed on this, one by John Rutz in Utah, that shows the penetration of ARs through the complex mountains really influences where the precipitation is heaviest. All right, so that's more on a climatology of extreme event standpoint. Let's turn our attention for a moment to changing climate. How do the ARs relate to changes in climate and what we expect to happen? This is a study from Dettinger 2005, and it goes back to 1900 with 100 years looking at climate models compared to observations, and then looking forward about 100 years. And you see how each of these lines diverges out this way? That's telling us that the climate models, some are saying Northern California is going to be drier than it is today. Others are saying it's going to be more wet. And that's what this vertical axis is the amount of precipitation deviation from the mean in Northern California over this century. Now, a more recent study led by David Pierce, also here at Scripps, showed that most of the variation between these models is a result of how the extreme precipitation events are handled. In California, that means the ARs. So one of the big uncertainties scientifically that we need to tackle is how do these models handle atmospheric rivers? Which ones do better? Which ones do worse? Why? Can we fix them or make them even better? And that led us to a set of science questions, and I say us here, a group of about a dozen scientists from across agencies, from across the West. We concluded that there were two major science goals we needed to tackle to look into this. One is having to do with the atmospheric river problem, which we've been going over here. Another one I want to introduce briefly here is the prediction of aerosols and their role in producing or influencing precipitation in California and the West. These are the two main topics of what we now call the CalWater experiments. And if we go to an example of the aerosol impacts, I want to highlight for you, remarkable result from our early CalWater work. Here in California, we made measurements. Professor Kim Prather at Scripps and others made measurements of aerosols in the Sierra Nevada, in the precipitation itself, that we could trace back to origins over Asia, and even more recently now we've determined even Africa. That dust gets blown up high into the atmosphere, transported at like the same altitudes you fly in an airline, a commercial airline jet, for example, and can get all the way to the U.S. And then if the clouds over the Sierra Nevada can poke up into that layer, that dust and the clouds interact with one another, and it can change the precipitation. And our study here showed that was an important possibility. The first study, the one I showed there, and then we've done more work with an aircraft going up there and sampling the dust as well. So that's the aerosol bit. Here's the atmospheric river part. If we look at the amount of rainfall in a storm in Northern California compared to how strong an atmospheric river is, what we see is the greater the AR strength and duration, the greater the precipitation. That's what this solid curve says, and it's 75% of the variance in storm total precipitation is explained by the ARs. That's huge. That means we now know a lot more about what we have to look for in order to predict that precipitation. However, notice that it doesn't predict it perfectly. See the variation from one event to there for the same amount of strength of an AR? And it turns out other factors, including aerosols, are part of that. So CalWater blends those two topics together into an experimental design. And I'll skip this because we've getting a little bit behind. The CalWater experiment is something this group imagined a few years ago, to be a major field campaign over about a five-year period where we'd go out in the winter and sample the atmospheric rivers offshore and the aerosols as well as onshore. And here's a schematic kind of version of an AR in the background, and this white area represents an aerosol plume coming from Asia and intersecting the AR. And you see myself and Kim Prather and Dan Kane are the co-leads of this. And then we have key agencies from NASA to NOAA to DOE, NSF, ONR, and DWR. And we were able to field all this equipment last winter, and I'll share a little bit more of that, about that with you. Here's a snapshot at the airport in Sacramento right after the three aircraft had arrived. We had them all there for a couple of weeks, and we had as many as we had at least one aircraft involved for over 8 weeks, which was represents a major field campaign in our field. The total cost for the campaign ended up being on the order of about $10 million. And now there's a slew of scientists who are going back to their labs, including ours here, to analyze those data and try to understand more which atmospheric rivers or how atmospheric rivers are represented in climate models, which models are better at them than others, how the aerosols are represented in the models and which ones are better than others and the like. And here's an example of a ground-based measurement network at Bodega Bay just north of San Francisco that was heavily sponsored by the National Science Foundation. And I should go back for just a moment and highlight that NOAA was a major sponsor of CalWater. You see here the two aircraft, the G4 and the P3, both of whom normal duty, essentially, is hurricane reconnaissance and science. And we have the Department of Energy G1, which is usually involved in air chemistry and climate science there. And we had Department of Energy and NOAA working well together. Each contributed about half of the experiment's total. And then the other agencies contributed about another 10 or 20%. So DOE and NOAA coordinated very well together with the aircraft. NSF sponsored equipment and scientists at Bodega Bay Marine Lab, including Kim Prather, as I mentioned earlier, and others from different universities. And then also we had the NOAA Ron Brown, which you can see here, is actually loaded with Department of Energy equipment. So once again, a really good example of our federal agencies working well together. And these are happening in response to this grassroots effort of planning from the science community that had identified aerosols and ARs as key science problems. And here's where the first part of the deployment went. Up here, we had 4 days of continuous AR conditions, then 3 days of continuous AR conditions here before docking in San Diego by chance at the end of the experiment. And let's see if this one will work.
California's weather and climate are products of proximity. Bordered by the Pacific Ocean and the Sierra Nevada mountains, we take what Mother Nature dishes out. Sometimes it's a bit too much. Other times, barely enough. Understanding which storms will crash and burn when they hit the coast and which could fill our reservoirs is a hard job. Even experienced forecasters can be surprised by how much or how little rain we end up with.
But the science and savvy regarding West Coast storms are improving. Researchers are flying into the heart of Pacific Ocean rain and snowmakers in a study called Cal Water to try to determine which weather systems are capable of flooding or could just get us out of the drought.
Well, this really helps us in understanding the mechanics of these storm systems better, which improves our ability to forecast and warn and develop response capabilities built around this. We don't have to wait until the rain is falling out of the sky and into our rain gauges to figure out what's going on.
The Cal Water fleet is comprised of 4 research aircraft and a ship, taking to the seas simultaneously to measure the strength and characteristics of incoming storms. But not just any storms, atmospheric rivers. Call them ARs for short. They're air currents that carry huge amounts of water vapor from the tropics to the West Coast. On average, each can transport as much water as 20 Mississippi rivers.
Well, it's exciting. I mean, to have this many types of observing assets available to us as researchers, it's phenomenal. Because now we can place planes in the atmospheric river, we can have planes flying above the atmospheric river, and we can have the ship right underneath the atmospheric river.
The California Department of Water Resources is a research partner on this study, but the bulk of the work is led by UC San Diego's Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Technical and flight support comes from NOAA, NASA, the Department of Energy, and the National Science Foundation, all working toward improving West Coast forecasting, a region of the country that has not, to date, gotten its share of attention. In California, we used to call them the Pineapple Express. Now we know the same pattern takes place all over the globe. Half the state's water supply comes from atmospheric rivers, often in powerful downpours that can hit in rapid succession.
Let's say fast forward a week and another one hits, and fast forward another week and another one hits, and it's twice as strong as either of these first two, then we've got the potential for a type of storm that could cause really catastrophic flooding. And it's really the story of landfalling atmospheric rivers that are really strong and stall out and actually create the kind of flooding in Sacramento that was seen with hurricanes in the East Coast, like Katrina and New Orleans and Sandy in New York.
On the flip side, we gradually slide into drought when we get fewer and fewer atmospheric rivers and don't get out until we get some more. 7 of the last 12 droughts ended in ARs. Cal Water's mission is to understand the forces that enhance or diminish their strength.
Quicker and more accurate flood safety warnings, better drought prediction, and the role of small particles in cloud formation are all aided by knowing what goes on offshore.
Kim Prather studies the small particles that give cloud drops a place to start. Little bits of dust and soot play a surprising role, not just in getting droplets to form, but in how much rain or snow actually falls. One atmospheric river that looks like another on satellite could yield 40% less precipitation if the source of the seed particles is man-made.
One of the things we hope to really get out of this study is to study enough storms where we can isolate storms that are affected mostly by Mother Nature versus those that also have the human influence. If we can do that enough times, maybe we can take a page from, you know, Mother Nature's book and really start to think about how does that seeding work.
Add on the risks posed by climate change, and you've targeted a real need for advanced research. How will this help scientists with future projections?
The major difference in the models is how they handle atmospheric rivers. The dry ones don't have enough. The wet ones have too many. we don't know what truth is until we go out and measure them. So that's a big part of what we're doing with the experiment, is we're collecting the first ever comprehensive data set on the strength and structure of ARs offshore to compare with these climate models and try to see which ones might be more accurate.
Now that the unique needs of the Western U.S. are being investigated, the day may come where we can know an AR's impact up to a week in advance. This will make California better prepared for the many critical water supply and flooding problems tied to atmospheric rivers, achieving the goals of those leading the Cal Water mission. This is Alyssa Lin with the California Department of Water Resources.
Okay, so that summarizes the Cal Water experiment. We've looked at ARs as far as their role in flood making and water supply, and worry about them in a climate change environment. But also, there are some things we can do today to take advantage of information that we're developing already and to target future developments to help with the drought situation we're in. And that capability we're hoping to invent is called forecast-informed reservoir operations. And I want to highlight that to you here. Using the Lake Mendocino up in the Russian River area, I mentioned Northern California and Sonoma County Water Agency. This is a picture of the reservoir from last July, and you can see it's nearly dry, about as low as it gets. And then below there you see a picture I happened to take near Monte Rio on the Russian River a few months earlier, and you can see it in flood with the very moist atmosphere and heavy rain. There had been about 10 inches of rain. So in the midst of this drought, or right beforehand, there had been actually a bit of a flood. And that's going to be part of the story of California climate, hydroclimate, is that we can have floods in the middle of droughts. And what that means, if you're a water manager, a flood control expert, you have to really worry about the other side of the equation. Even if today you're in an extreme drought, the potential of a flood is just around the corner, and vice versa. If you've just had a flood, that could very well be the last rain you see for a year. So let me explore that briefly here. And I should highlight that there was just, this slide is from the Sonoma County Climate Adaptation Forum at Sonoma State University, very well attended with city planners, county leaders, agency leaders in the area, and they all got together to look at climate adaptation, and one of the things they learned about was the work that we're doing. So this is a little bit of a complicated diagram, but it's at the heart of the last bit of the talk here, and I want to step you through it. So here we have, in the vertical axis, the amount of storage of water behind in Lake Mendocino, behind what's called Coyote Valley Dam, and it's in acre feet, and you can see it goes up to about 100,000 acre feet. And now I want to show you this gold curve, the dashed line, which goes up and down in a systematic way. And it's doing that over the course of about 2.5 years on the horizontal axis. So this is the story of how much water was behind Lake Mendocino over the last 2.5 years, or not quite the last, but just before then. And this dashed curve, though, represents what's called the rule curve, which was developed when the dam was built in the 1960s, and represents the allowable amount of water, the maximum allowable amount of water in the reservoir. At this time of year, it's allowed to have up to 68,000 acre feet, and then at this time of year, up to 110,000 acre feet. Anybody want to venture a guess why they're different? Yeah, flooding in the winter is one of the reasons the dam exists, and you want to have the dam somewhat empty to absorb the flood. But that very same reservoir can be used for floods, for water supply in the summer, and so you can allow it to refill. So hypothetically, that's how this dam's supposed to work. And the Army Corps of Engineers, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, runs the operations in the winter, essentially, and the Sonoma County Water Agency runs it in the summer. However, if you look at reality here, this blue curve is how much water was actually behind the dam. And luckily, in March of 2012, there were a couple of good AR storms that helped refill it right when it was allowed to do that. And then it declined during the dry season. And then we had a big AR and then another big AR, and it actually encroached into the flood pool. That's the jargon, which says to the flood control people, we've got too much water behind the dam. We need to get rid of it so that if there's another flood that comes a few days later, we're prepared for that. So what did they do? Just like they're supposed to, they released that water down to the level they were supposed to. But then notice the green curve is the rainfall. And after that happened, it basically went about a year with hardly raining at all. And the reservoir was left unable to refill in the spring, and ended up in this very dire condition down here at the end of in early 2014. And that has continued. Luckily, this winter, it refilled back up to about right here. But now we're looking at a forecast with really no precipitation for the foreseeable future, meaning weeks or week or so up north. And the reservoir is likely to be in sort of this same position next year. So the challenge is, can we save some of this water, which is what the print says there. Okay, so how do we do this? We've formed an interagency team. People have been thinking about this, by the way, in concept for several years, but it's been very hard to get traction on it, partly because it's such a tough job to provide flood control. It's also very tough to provide water supply, and the rules are very strict. So there's a little bit of wiggle room, but not very much. So what we've done to tackle this, first of all, is we're building on the discoveries over the last decade about atmospheric rivers, our ability to predict them to a degree today, the potential to predict them even better in the future, and tie that together with the engineering community, the water management community, the flood control community, to explore the possibility of using forecasts to help drive reservoir decisions. Remember I mentioned that those curves were, that one curve was created in the 1950s or early 60s? At the time, it wasn't envisioned that forecasts of weather were reliable enough to make any decisions in reservoir operations based on the forecast. So it was not included in the options for making decisions on reservoir operations. There have been a few ways to sort of build around that a little bit over time, but no one's really tackled it head on. And what we've done here is hypothesize that because ARs are the primary cause of flooding and produce half the water supply, our forecast challenge sort of boils down to how well can we predict these ARs and how can we improve on that? And then once we do that, how can we improve the stream flow prediction to get water into the dams, right? Because soil can be dry and can absorb a lot of rain initially, essentially an entire AR worth, and then before running off, so you really have to have a couple of them. So anyhow, we formed up this team, and the icons on here are important. We have USGS, Scripps, Army Corps of Engineers, California Department of Water Resources, Bureau of Reclamation, NOAA, and a local water agency there as well up in the upper Russian River. And myself and Jay Jaspers, the chief engineer for Sonoma County Water Agency, co-chair this committee. And we have federal, state, and regional partners. We also have partnerships with some ongoing programs that federal agencies have to focus on the Russian River problems in general. And our project, called FIRO, F-I-R-O, is a collaborative effort across all these people. Our very first meeting was right here in our backyard down at the Forum, one of the most beautiful facilities for meetings and stimulating discussion and creativity. And we had at this meeting, I'm very proud to say, meteorologists, climatologists, hydrologists, civil engineers, biologists, and economists. And we're all trying to work together to try to figure out how to approach this problem of forecast-informed reservoir operations. If we can crack the code on this in a way by inventing the forecasts that are needed, which involves a lot of science underneath that to achieve it, including the aerosol problem and the AR problem, we have the potential to keep more water behind our existing dams. If we can do that, we will be able to be more resilient to the kind of drought we have today and what we may be facing in the future. So this team, interestingly, very technical people, you know, very critical. We took an informal vote, not the people on this picture, but there were 12 of us on this committee in a meeting a month ago, and we did a little democratic thing, took little yellow sticky tabs. Everybody could vote, you know, anonymously. And the question was, do you think that this FIRO concept is going to work? 5 years from now, do you think we'll be able to do this? 12 out of 12 said yes. This is from a very skeptical, technical community of people. Of course, they're in the meeting because they're sort of interested. But the fact is, to have them agree with this was a very big milestone for me personally, and it gives me a lot of hope that we have a new tool in our toolbox for water management in California, potentially in the coming years. And I'm glad to say that there's some serious discussion about pursuing the development of that full ahead here over the next couple of years. And let me just let someone else put that in their words. This is a woman who's on the board of directors for the Sonoma County Water Agency, and they have a video showing her explaining the situation.
Hi, I'm Shirley Zane. I'm a director on the Sonoma County Water Agency board, and I'm here atop one of our water tanks in Taylor Mountain to talk to you today about drought. While you see some beautiful green hills behind me, don't be fooled. We're still in a drought. That's why we have these storage tanks everywhere, and the Sonoma County Water Agency is doing everything we can to get every last drop. An atmospheric river is essentially a river in the sky. It dumps a huge amount of water onto us. Actually, about 50% of our water supply from the Russian River watershed comes from an atmospheric river. Atmospheric rivers also cause floods. 85% of the floods that we've experienced here in Sonoma County were caused by atmospheric rivers. At the Sonoma County Water Agency, we know that if we can detect when those atmospheric rivers are coming, we can preserve the water that we already have. That's why Sonoma County Water Agency has partnered with the Scripps Institution of Oceanography and the Center for Western Weather and Water Extremes to determine the role of atmospheric rivers in filling Lake Mendocino and offering enhanced predictability to retain water without increasing flood risk. Our water agency is working hard to conserve every last drop of water. Thank you for your partnership. For more information, visit SonomaCountyWater.org.
Okay, that's the last video, I promise. I'm very pleased, though, that people have taken the time to produce these stories, video-wise, in their own words, to try to describe what we're doing and how they're working with us. One of the key things that we're doing, and frankly why I moved to Scripps, was to create this Center for Western Weather and Water Extremes to bring greater attention and teamwork to these problems. And you can see on the left here, I want to highlight the fact that our mission and vision extend beyond the atmospheric river topic associated with this yellow area to the southwest monsoon and what we call upslope storms, like caused the major flood in Denver and Boulder 2 years ago, and also some Great Plains deep convection that happens to be a key feature in some areas of the West. Frankly, the systems in weather prediction that we need for this region are different than they are on the East Coast. They're different than are needed in the Midwest. Our climate challenges are different, and our hope is that this center will bring additional capability to bear on these problems. And I just want to highlight a couple points here. Is our mission and our goal. You heard most of that already. Sonoma County Water Agency is a major partner. We're also partnering with the San Diego Supercomputer Center. You can see Mike Norman in the lower picture there on the right. And we're building a new weather prediction model focused on the AR problem and heavy rainfall for California. When I say building it, what we're doing is we're not starting from scratch. The meteorological community has a fantastic model called the WRF model, W-R-F, but it can be tailored to different problems. And our job right here is to tailor it to the California problems to start with. And how do we make sure that it's the best model? Is by focusing on our problems. We don't have to worry about it being good at hurricanes. Frankly, that's not the issue we're tackling. We don't have to worry about it being good at tornadoes. That's really not a big issue in the West. We need to worry about it for water. And the Cal Water experiment gives us the state-of-the-art data to help train it and evaluate it in a way to take advantage of it. We also are surrounded here at Scripps and UC San Diego by some of the world's experts on how the ocean influences these very storms that we depend on. So we have a formula for this approach programmatically, and we're working together with San Diego Supercomputing Center very closely. In addition, and I think maybe the last slide, I want to highlight one of the tools that we're developing. I'm not going to go through all the details on this slide, but the bottom line is there are specialized forecasting tools that we've envisioned and we're starting to create, and this is in particular partnership with Plymouth State University. And what we have here is the coast, the west coast of the U.S., and each dot represents a position on the coast. And this graph goes out 16 days into the future for each of those positions on the coast, like San Diego right there. And what we see here going out is the light blue means none of the forecast models at the time were predicting AR conditions hitting San Diego. And this was back in late January. But if you went up here to, say, northern or southern Oregon, what we saw is the greens here and the yellows say a little bit of a chance about 1 week out, and then some tempting possibilities about 2 weeks out. This is pretty much dreamland out here for weather forecasters because we don't really have a lot of predictability there. But interestingly, in this case, the biggest storm we had in Northern California this year was evidence of that was seen 2 weeks ahead in this forecast. Now, there were other times when we saw this same signal in this tool, nothing happened in California. So we have a lot of work to do to understand that. But by bringing our focus and attention to this, by developing the resources and sponsors that are needed for it, by really focusing our efforts, we can develop some new things that others can use, not just ourselves, but many other groups. And then I just want to highlight here, I think this is the last one, that we had an atmospheric river in December hit the Russian River area, 10 inches of rain in about a day, 12,000 acre feet of water storage increase on that very dry reservoir, which, by the way, remember, is about enough for maybe 50,000 households. That's a good dose of water. And it put the local river over flood stage in Guerneville. So the fact is we're in a drought at this time, and we had a flood simultaneously. So please, if you're interested in more information, feel free to take a look at our website. If you Google CW3E, I'm very proud to say it's the first thing that comes up. And it's because it's such a screwy name, I know. But anyhow, thank you very much. So I think the question was about, are we doing anything to understand the potential role of these aerosol particles, and if we could influence those in some way, and would that have an impact?
Or anything else.
What our first step is to make sure that we understand how the aerosols interact with clouds and precipitation in a way that represents reality. Hence the data collection we had this last winter and in some earlier winters. And there's a lot of good advances there. Our model that I mentioned that we're going to build for the West, we call it West Wharf, by the way, we're going to take advantage of that state-of-the-art information on how aerosols impact clouds and precipitation. So that's the first step. And we think that by understanding that better, we might be able to isolate periods of time when we don't have as much of that cloud seed, natural cloud seed up there, and therefore we might not get as much precipitation. The question was, in a worst-case scenario, how far inland do you think it would flood in San Diego? Well, much like the real estate thing, you know, location, location, location. I think it's highly variable. It's hard for me to say what that would be depending on where you're at. But clearly in some low-lying areas, it would be more of a problem than elsewhere.
Way in the back there.
Martin, you said there were two radars in California in 2014. Do you know how many there were in 2013?
2013, I believe there were two as well. And in 2011, which was our last real wet year, I think there were 14. An average, like I said, is somewhere in the 6 to 8 range. We are way behind.
Yes. Does California need more reservoir storage capacity?
That's a policy question that's above my pay grade, by the way.
Sure.
The question, I'm sorry, I should repeat, and it's a very good question, one being asked a lot, is does California need additional storage in the form of new reservoirs? And truly that is a question for policymakers well above my pay grade. What I can say is that the work we're doing to try to take advantage, better advantage of existing reservoirs, that same methodology could be applied to new reservoirs as well to make them even more efficient. So the calculation of what's really needed, that's a much bigger question.
Just very quickly, living 8 blocks from here, it isn't the flooding, it's the landslides that are going to happen. We have topography controls, and when we're above the flood level, perhaps, but what that hill is going to do behind your house, another matter entirely.
Very good point. The comment was about how landslides are really a vital part of the challenge here. In many neighborhoods, the flooding itself, directly water inundation, is not so much of a risk. But indeed, you don't have to look far away to see examples of past landslides. Correct me if I didn't get you right, but I think you're asking, what is the difference between an AR and what we've been calling a winter storm? Yeah, so we have many winter storms each year in the cool season, like fall and winter in California. But only a handful of them are really charged up with the water vapor contents and the winds that the ARs have. So the ARs are really a subset of the winter storms. In fact, those that have the largest water vapor contents and the strongest low-altitude winds. And by the way, I should highlight that although I focused most on rain here, there's a nice study from NASA, JPL, and UCLA showing 40% of the Sierra snowpack is from a handful of AR events each year on average as well. I believe the question was, what is the relationship between ARs and the jet stream, and the particles moving around?
Correct.
So that's a very good question as well. The jet stream, as we normally think of it in meteorology and in everyday life, is really up at the altitudes we fly in commercial airliners. And they can be 100, 150, 200 miles an hour. And you'd think that's where it's really important in terms of the water vapor transport. But I don't know if anybody's ever noticed what the temperature is up there. Minus 30, minus 40. The amount of water vapor the air can hold is related to its temperature. The colder the air, the less water vapor it can hold. That's why when air goes up a mountain and expands and cools, it condenses. The water vapor condenses. So by the time you get up to the upper level jet stream, there's not much water moving around. The atmospheric river is down in the lowest, say, 5 or 10,000 feet. And right there is where the air is warmest normally and is right next to the ocean in many cases, right above the ocean, and has the chance to transport the most water vapor. And there are times, in fact, in one of the P3 flights, the NOAA aircraft flights, we had 100-mile-an-hour winds at 3,000 feet above the surface, and it was just soupy, wet, moist air. So that's where you're getting your water vapor transport, and that's what the ARs are. How do the ARs relate to El Nino and what's the formation of the ARs in that regard? So ARs are part of what are called extratropical cyclones, so a big sort of comma-shaped storm over the ocean with a low-pressure center. Meteorology for a long time has studied that low-pressure center, but what we found is that the AR is sort of away from there, 500 to 1,000 kilometers away, and is where the moist air is that matters to our water supply and to our flooding. So it's offset from the cyclone. The cyclone itself is a child of the temperature gradient between the pole and the equator, cold to warm. That's a form of potential energy. And if the right disturbance forms on it, it can grow of its own accord and create kinetic energy in the form of wind and a cyclone, that extratropical cyclone I mentioned. So it's a combination of the extratropical cyclone growing on the polar to equator temperature gradient. That gradient is not all just equal everywhere. It tends to be concentrated, and that's what we call the storm track. It's concentrated horizontally. That's what we call the storm track. So El Nino has a major impact on the storm track, and therefore the cyclones, and therefore the atmospheric rivers. That's a whole course in meteorology. I butchered it, sorry, but anyhow. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.